Hello and welcome back to Feet First, a podcast focusing on the front of the pack in the UK trail and ultra scene. My name's Ed Scott, and in this episode, I'm bringing you a conversation with Hugh Tibbs, fresh off the back of his win and course record at the Autumn 100 hosted by Centurion Running. This is Hugh's second time on the podcast. He came on back in May after winning and also setting a course record at the North Downsway 50. At the time, he was a relatively fresh face on the scene. He had come second at South Downsway 100 before, but it's safe to say that he has gone on to bigger and better things this summer. He had a string of incredible results throughout the summer, racing almost every month. He followed up North Downsway 50 course record with a second place again at South Downsway 100, second only to Mark Derbyshire's course record of 13:42. He followed that up with a new course record at Race to the Stones, running 7 hours 41 in the 100k there on one of the hottest days of the year. I think anyone would be forgiven after a summer like that for taking it easy, but Hugh just ran a new course record, as I say, at Autumn 100, 13 hours, 3 minutes and 59 seconds, which is officially the fastest trail 100 miler ever run in the UK by a hefty margin, almost 40 minutes faster than Mark Derbyshire's South Downsway 100 earlier this summer. Obviously, Autumn 100, a very different race to South Downsway 100. More or less flat, it's four legs out and back from Goring along the Thames Path and the Ridgeway. Very low key compared to some of the other big races here in the UK, but perfect for running fast. And as you'll hear from Hugh, conditions were more or less perfect as well this year. So great to find out more from Hugh about the summer he's had, his run at this race, and what his plans are for the future. Because I think of all the runners in the UK at the moment running certainly the more runnable ultramarathons, I think that Hugh seems to have the desire to step up to that international level. It's just a matter of if and when he's going to do that and how he's going to approach running some of the bigger races that he has in his calendar. With Hugh's incredible record-setting performance and the publishing of this episode, I think the perfect time to announce I'm taking a short break from the podcast for the month of November. The podcast started back in December 2024, so I want to take a month off to just recharge the batteries after essentially a year of continuous podcasting and plan a little bit for what next year looks like. I've been really overjoyed with the reception that the podcasters have, and I'm really grateful to everyone who has tuned in and said nice things about it. So we will be back in December with coverage of all the big winter races. Good time, I think, to tune in to some of the back catalogue. If you scroll back all the way to December 2024, you can listen to some episodes focusing on some of these big winter races, which are coming back around again. Episode 1, I spoke to my friend Ali Whitlock after her third place finish the year before at Winter Downs 200, then followed that up with a chat with Emma Stewart, who won the women's race last year. John Kelly, then I spoke to him ahead of the Spine race, as well as Jess Johnson, the Winter Spine Sprint record holder, and James Elson ahead of his Spine race. This is at the beginning of 2025. Then spoke to Kim Collison, episode 6, which I still think is one of my favourite episodes I've ever recorded. Kim is just super open and honest about the experience, and it's very raw in his mind when we speak. Then moved into Arc of Attrition, which I spent a lot of time talking to people about. Spoke to Dan Weller, ahead of the race, and then Sarah Page afterwards. She took second place in the 100 miler. Also spoke to Rebecca Devereaux, who came third in the Women's Winter Spine Sprint. Lewis Ryan, who won the 100 miler. Spoke to Jack Chamberlain, who came fourth, and then Hugh Chatfield, Keith Wigley, second and third, and of course Tom Evans, who won the race, and I also spoke to Elsie Davis, who won the women's 50-miler. So loads of podcasts that you may not have listened to if you weren't listening to the podcast back then, but you can scroll back through your feed and listen to those ahead of the races that are coming up this year. All right, before the podcast begins, just want to take a moment to thank Janji for their continued support of Feet First. If you haven't heard of Janji, they make absolutely awesome high-performance running apparel that is designed with adventure in mind to help you explore and connect with the world around you. Every Janji capsule is inspired by a different region of the world. They partner with local artists from around the world to create unique designs that tell the story of their culture, or their geography, or their heritage. So the new Autumn 2025 collection is inspired by the Alaskan Arctic's rugged wilderness But there's lots of amazing Janji capsules that are produced, and they're really one of a kind. So if you want to check out Janji's amazing range, you can use the code FEETFIRST when you purchase from janji.com. That's J-A-N-J-I. And that code will get you 15% off your next order, which will really help support the podcast. And let's be honest, as we move into the colder months, we may all be looking to stock up on some longer sleeve t-shirts and some warmer clothes. So head to janji.com, use the code FEETFIRST to let them know that the podcast sent you, and that will really, really help support the podcast, and you will get some new awesome gear in the process. All right, here is Hugh Tibbs. Hugh Tibbs, welcome back to Feet First.
Thanks for having me back on.
A pleasure to have you on. I feel like in the, what is it, 5-6 months since we last had you on, you have been on quite a journey. How does it feel to be sat here with the summer that you've just had behind you, reflecting upon that?
I feel a bit tired, to be honest. I've done quite a lot of races, so about a race a month. But feel pretty good. I feel like, so we spoke after the North Downs Way, and that was maybe 5 months ago. It feels longer than that ago. So I think a lot's happened since then. But from a running perspective, I think I've progressed quite a lot since then, and like I can see from my races, or most of my races, like a steady progression of improvement, which is quite satisfying. But yeah, I'm still kind of in the mindset of like a kid in a sweet shop with races. I've still got another race in November and another one in December and January, and yeah, so I'm still sort of see myself as relatively new to it, and I'm still learning a lot, I think. So I'm not kind of, my mindset in some ways is quite similar to 5 months ago, of just like try different types of races, race a lot, try and learn from experience. But I'm very happy with the way it's gone in the last 5 months running wise.
Because you didn't come into this year with. You're like completely new to all of this. You've run ultras in the past, but you've also got a strong marathon and road pedigree. How much do you think the progression you've seen this summer is a result of fitness and strength, and how much has it been a learning curve in terms of managing yourself on these longer efforts?
It's hard to say. I'd say from, I think my sort of road, like marathon type fitness has improved steadily. And I think most of the improvement in my times has been the fact that I'm just fitter generally. But definitely a portion of the improvement is due to just experience of doing the races and learning from, you know, you learn even just like managing myself in aid stations and stuff like that. Like coming from a road background, you have no experience of that. So doing races, just like sorting yourself out with your bottles and aid stations, even things like that, they improve, you know, every race you do, and you get more used to it. And I think there's certain elements of ultras which you don't really need to consider much in road running, like over the marathon distance. Things like hydration and like electrolytes and stuff, where you can kind of maybe get away with it in a marathon, but when you get into ultras, you really can't. So yeah. I think you kind of have to do these races to learn more about yourself, and it's kind of like I think it's a two-way thing. So I feel like from doing ultras, I've probably learned a lot about my body and a lot more about the sort of different aspects of running, which you maybe don't have to think about for the shorter distances, which I can then translate back to shorter distances. So I'm not someone that's kind of like done with road running and marathons. That still kind of interests me. So I feel like I've learned a lot by doing ultras, and I can like transfer some of those lessons back towards doing marathons. I've got a marathon next month coming up.
No way.
Yeah, so I think it's mostly fitness in terms of the improvement. I think ultimately if you've got good marathon fitness, that's going to translate well to especially runnable trail races. And I do most of my running on road because living in London.
Well, let's talk about some of the special days you've had. I mean, we're obviously here to talk about Autumn 100, which I want to get into. But before we do, so we spoke after North Downs Way 50, where you set a new course record. Plenty of people would have rested on their laurels after a run like that, but you went straight on to South Downs Way 100. where you ran 14:13, which was the third fastest time ever. Just so happened that Mark Derbyshire showed up and ran the fastest time ever. That must have been quite a special day, right? It felt like the whole, certainly the whole of the UK ultra scene or the South UK ultra scene was sort of watching that race from afar and watching all that, all the magic unfold up on the downs.
Yeah, it was a very cool occasion. Like there was a lot of sort of attention on the race, I guess, and live stream and stuff. So I'm not really used to that, although I did South Downs Way the year before, I did have some sort of exposure to that. But with the South Downs Way, that was my first, I'd call it my first like proper long distance ultra. I had done a 50K a bit before and a backyard ultra, but so that the South Downs Way as a course, like, is quite special to me. And that first, the race in 2024 went really well. And that's kind of, I guess, where I realized that, you know, this might suit me quite well. So then going back in 2025 with a little bit more expectation, it was, in a way, it was a bit more daunting because I was kind of expected to do better, where the year before I was kind of, nobody knew who I was. So I was maybe a little bit more nervous than I was the year before, but mostly very excited. And just the opportunity to run with loads of really good ultra runners, especially mostly from the UK, and just, yeah, it was just a really cool experience. We had a big group of 10, 15, maybe even up to 15 people in the first hour or so, and it was just like, yeah, it was great to just meet people, chat to people, you know, talk about experiences, talk about races, really nice atmosphere. And then, yeah, I guess in the second half it gets hard, and I think I had a really good day. Maybe the best I could have had, because I think I had some issues. I got quite dehydrated. The thing about the South Downs is, even if it's 20 degrees, it's sunny, you start to feel it. And so it really wasn't ideal running conditions as far as I'm concerned. What Mark did was especially impressive considering that. But yeah, on the weather forecast, you see 20 degrees. Like, what are they complaining about? That's not too far off perfect conditions. But it really gets to you on that exposed course. The conditions were not ideal, but not terrible considering it was June. But yeah, it was just a great experience. Very very happy with the outcome.
Yeah, it's funny. I was watching the Javelina 100 unfold this last weekend, which is out in Arizona, and I think that's probably similar kind of temperature. Obviously, it's Arizona in October; it's quite warm still. But I think there's quite a big difference between hot in America and hot in the UK because of the humidity that we get. And I sometimes think people neglect to notice that, is that 35 degrees in a dry heat is almost preferable to 25 in a really humid.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Javelina. Yeah, that's what I was on. I was watching a bit of that. It's on my radar. I think.
I was gonna ask you about it later. I feel like it lends itself to your. As when you see the times people are running as well.
The winning times this year were a bit silly. But yeah, very impressive. Very impressive runs.
A quick break to thank Petzl for supporting Feet First. Petzl, if you haven't heard of them, have been at the forefront of hands-free lighting solutions for over 50 years. They are trusted by a roster of UK runners, including Damien Hall, Kim Collison, and Sabrina Virgie, as well as internationally renowned athletes like my personal hero, four-time UTMB champion Francois Dayen. Petzl have lit the way for countless world-class trail running performances, and I'm really proud to say that they are the official headlamp sponsor of Feet First. What makes Petzl different is their reactive lighting technology, which they have exclusively developed. It instantly provides the right lighting at the right time, sensing and adapting and responding to your surroundings so that you can stay focused on the run, not the settings on your headlamp. So as we head into the darker months, if you're in the market for a new headlamp, then check out Petzl's awesome range at the Centurion Ultra Running Store, another one of our sponsors here on Feet First. If anything piques your interest, you can use the code FEETFIRST10 to get 10% off your next headlamp, and that will help support the podcast. So that's FEETFIRST10 at the Centurion Ultra Running Store for 10% off all Petzl products. All right, back to Hugh Tibbs. Well, one of the guys you were racing with for a while at South Hunsway 100 was Joe Turner, mm-hmm. who ultimately dropped out. But you reunited with him for a bit of a jaunt at Race to the Stones. Again, a baking hot day. You'd have been forgiven for not chasing the course record, but you did break it by about 9 minutes. Talk me through that experience, because that felt like where South Hunsway 100 was a competitive sort of battle. Race to the Stones, you were more out front on your own for a while, although I know Joe was kind of hot on your heels, right?
Yeah. It definitely felt a race the vast majority of the way. I think there's a point where I got told maybe around 75, 80K where I had a bit of a gap, like maybe the same gap to the course record as Joe. So I thought, okay, maybe it is just like, this is about like controlling the situation and just making sure you don't blow up, basically. But most of the way, yeah, it was very much a race of, I was asking John, who was crewing me, like, how far's Joe? Like, that was my main concern. And not like up until maybe 60K, it was always just a couple of minutes behind. So he would see him, and then sort of he'd have to get in the car, get to the next point to meet me. But yeah, so it very much felt like a race, and like going into it, I think I definitely felt like, you know, I had a shot, but I was definitely the underdog. I mean, Joe over 100K is pretty formidable opponent, so. I don't think he had his, like, he didn't have a perfect day out there, but he also ran really well. I mean, it was very, very hot. And actually, yeah, out of all of the results in the summer, maybe that's one that stands out as being one I'm probably, yeah, most satisfying, definitely, and one that I'm proud of. It's great when like a plan comes together, and like in that situation, with the forecast and then what the weather eventually was, it's, you know, it was got into the maybe mid-30s, low 30s, maybe mid-30s. So it was always going to be about like how you can manage the heat. And historically, I've always been rubbish at that, really. Even in the Southlands way, when it was a lot cooler, I didn't really have any strategies for like planned in advance for cooling, like kind of did it, winged it, got my crew to get some ice and put some ice in the cap, but didn't have like an ice bandana or anything like that. And I remember, I think it was a couple of weeks before the Race to the Stones where Western States was on, and there's a lot of coverage and sort of, I guess, media attention on how the athletes were cooling. So I got a lot of good strategies from that and thought, okay, this is going to be a perfect opportunity to try and implement that. But like the planning of that, of like when you would see your crew and like working out how long it would maybe take the crew to get from one point to another and how long it would take you and the pacing strategy and with, you know, with the course record and stuff factored in, yeah, there's quite a lot of planning that goes into it, I guess. And when it all goes like pretty much exactly how you planned it, it is very satisfying. So, and that's one where the job of the crew is like, it's debatably as hard as the runner, because it's just so, there's a lot to do. It's not like you're just getting to a point and handing a drink. Like, you've got to, like, every drink that I was getting, it was like chilled, really cold. Like, he was happening with ice every time I got there. The stress of getting like to the next point in, you know, you might only have like 40 minutes to get there. So, it all worked really well. It's very satisfying, that one.
There's a couple of cooling strategies that come to mind at Western States that I saw. One was the, obviously, Caleb Olsen's remarkable string vest technology, whatever you want to call that, which I'm sure we'll see more of in the next few years. But the other was the paddling pool of ice. Were you tempted to implement something like that? Go for a swim?
Yeah, I didn't have the resources to implement that. But it's amazing. I haven't got the fashion sense to implement what he was wearing, but
I think you could pull it off. I think you'd be right.
Not sure about that one, but lots of ice. I mean, ice, it's incredible. I couldn't believe how much of a game changer it was. I think I would go as far as saying like that I don't felt like the temperature slowed me down that much. It was more the time. Putting the ice in ice bandanas and stuff. So maybe I had like 10 minutes of stoppage time where on a cooler day, if I was just grabbing drinks, I might have only had a couple of minutes stoppage. So I think it adds time that way, but I think I kind of nullified the impact of the weather pretty well. Maybe not completely, but like 95% of the impact of the heat I could kind of control if you get ice regularly enough. Yeah, it was tough. I was glad I was done by like 2-3 p.m. because it was a weird one where like it was actually hottest in the sort of afternoon, late afternoon. By that point, I was finished and Joe was finished. So fair play to anyone who stuck it out, especially over like a couple of days. It was really tough weather. And well done to you.
Thank you. Yeah, I said it to Joe though. It's a slightly hollow victory when you guys ran it faster the day before with 50k already in your legs.
Oh wow, we had the momentum, didn't we, from the first half? So
that's it.
We just continued forward. Yeah.
You got a flying start. I'm curious about how you approach sort of staying fresh in between all these races, like racing back to back and not racing, you know, short races by any means. You know, 100 miler in June, 100k in July. What are you doing in between? In terms of training, I mean, is it more just about getting back to freshness and maintaining rather than getting any volume in?
I don't think I'm doing anything special. I definitely don't have any like gadgets, or I don't use supplements. And so I think to be honest, I think a lot of it's luck that I just recover quickly, genetics or whatever. But I tend to take it easy, do no running for a few days, and then just get back into easy running. Maybe like 5 days after, and then avoid doing anything high intensity for the first week back. But actually this year I've tended to not do that much high intensity stuff. So most of my running has just been relatively easy running. So I find like, I think you only really know when you're recovered when you do like the high intensity stuff and you do races and stuff. And for example, with South Downs Way and then Race to the Stones, that was a 4 week gap. I hadn't really tested whether I had properly recovered from that. And then I guess you find out in the race, whether you've recovered, and like, luckily in that one I had, but yeah, I guess I'm, in the training, I'm taking it relatively easy. I'm not doing huge amounts of high intensity stuff in between races, which are 4 weeks apart. But ultimately, I think, yeah, a lot of it does come down just to like, I'm just lucky that I tend to recover quickly from races. And probably the same, for like train, like longer training runs as well. I tend to not, you know, be too fatigued from them. And that's partly maybe why I've been quite successful in the last 6 months or so, because I've been able to like race regularly and have the benefits of like a hard effort without, you know, too much cost in terms of the recovery. But I definitely don't have any secrets to impart.
I'm just curious about if you're able to fit in any big weeks in between these events. I mean,
no,
I saw on your Strava you've had a few like 100k plus weeks in the build up to Autumn 100, right?
Yeah. I'm like, my Strava is not the most reliable source, because I don't record all my runs in my watch. Everything I record goes on Strava. It automatically uploads. But if there's a loop where I'm just doing an easy run and I know the distance, sometimes I just won't bother even starting my watch. I quite like the freedom of not having like a beep or showing kilometer splits or even thinking about that. And I think if I'm just doing easy running, I know the distance, I just don't need to switch on, I don't need to record onto my watch. So there's some easy, most of my training's on there, but some of my easy running where I'm just doing like a loop, which I know well, won't be on there. But I'd say like a week, I'd probably have a week after a race where I'm recovering, and I go basically back to normal the following week. And then I guess, if you're doing a race every month, it's not just the like recovery, it's the what do you do before the next race. And because I do race quite often, I find like I don't have or need like that long taper into it. And so I feel like I can definitely get like 2 weeks of like normal training in after like a week of less training, like where I'm recovering. I may have 2 weeks of like relatively normal training, and then a week leading up to a race, I'd maybe I'd reduce the mileage, but I wouldn't take much longer than a week. So I guess that helps as well, because if you're tapering like 2 weeks and you're racing every 4 weeks, then and you're recovering for a week, that gives you just 1 week of normal training a month.
Yeah.
But yeah, I found just from personal experience that if I taper too long, I start to just get these injuries start occurring for some reason. So I find I tend to like running every day still, or like almost every day. Even if you're cutting down the distances in the lead up. But I don't do particularly high mileage in general. Like I'd say 80 to 90 miles maybe in the last 6 months, probably been the average.
Well, it sounds like you found a pretty good groove in the first part of the summer, and then from the outside looking in, at least, you hit a bit of a wall, or you had a bit of a wobble at Grand Raid Pyrenees. I'm just curious to get your take on that experience. Like, what did you learn from that race? Because it's so different to the races that you'd had success in the months before.
Can we not just discuss my successful races, Ed? What's going on?
We can gloss
over. I said before that we shouldn't. No.
Do you want to talk about Dino Dash instead? We can talk.
Dino Dash was a huge success here. with Grand Raid, like, I kind of went into it with low expectations for myself and seeing it as just a kind of experiment of how will I do in a big mountain ultra. And I guess it kind of went as it should have done, is that I found it really hard. I tried to get like a bit of specific training in what I could in London, and then had a couple of days in the Brecon Beacons, and me and a friend Simon, who also did the race, we went out to the Alps and did the UTMB route a few weeks before. So I did have some sort of specific training. But yeah, going into it, I was kind of very much like, just try and get round the course. But as an experience, it was it was mixed. I've seen the UTMB route a couple of times now, and the route in GLP is a lot tougher. Because the UTMB route is mostly pretty good running. Like, I would consider myself very weak on technical sort of downhill. But UTMB, there's only a few sections where I'm like, I'd be losing, you know, a fair amount of time and someone who's really efficient going down there. Where GLP, it was like most of the race, I was thinking that. But yeah, it was a cool experience. Like, I went off, maybe got a little bit excited, but went off with like this kind of lead group. And for the first few hours where it was like pretty much, or first 2 hours at least, or 2.5 hours where it was pretty much up and flat, I was with the lead runner who ended up getting under 22 hours and like a massive course record, amazing run. He was kind of off, but then there was a group of, I was with Mark Derbyshire and a few others, and it felt pretty good. And like, I wouldn't say necessarily comfortable, but I felt like, you know, I was running a little bit within myself. Maybe I'm probably going too fast for a 24-hour-ish race, but I felt pretty strong on the up. And then we entered like more technical kind of terrain, and it was kind of like up flat, and I was still just about sort of hanging on, but struggling a little bit with my footing and stuff. And then you get to like the top point, and it goes down like over technical terrain, like kind of boulder field type stuff. And I was running with Mark, and it was just like, see you later. It was gone. And it's just like, it's like the computer game. It just goes from like easy mode to difficult mode. And it's just like, and I was just, from that point onwards, it was just a bit of I got overtaken by, so I was maybe like fourth at that point, and then got maybe settled around 10th place. But I found that, yeah, I was losing big amounts of time on the descent, but also energy, because you're having to like stop yourself. And I found the technical descents, as I expected, I found that to be very challenging. But overall, as an experience, it was quite, overall, I'd say like moderately I took some positives from it. I wasn't disappointed. I never sort of went in there with a sort of expectation that I was going to do, you know, super well. So I kind of wanted to finish the race because it was on the World Trail Majors, the way the points work. You know, I've done quite well in the South Downs Way. If I finished, I would probably have gone into like quite high on the overall leaderboard. So I was kind of like, whatever you do, just finish the race. But it's amazing how, like, when you start feeling sick, it's about to get dark, you're like, nah. I don't care anymore. I just want to go to bed. But yeah, it was an eye-opener in terms of like how technical some of these races can be. And I'm pretty confident that I'm not gonna be able to put myself in a position to be competitive in those types of races, and I'm kind of okay with that. Something like a UTMB may be a bit more viable, but it was hard. But I listened to the James Elson's race review of it, so I wasn't surprised when I encountered very, very tough terrain, very rocky terrain. And even the bits that aren't rocky, it was just like, there was like running through fields, like it was also like bits which were like fell running, just like ankles subjected to a lot of grief, which they're not used to.
Hard terrain to replicate in Southeast London.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. Did you race in September? We've recapped month by month, and I'm just wondering if I've missed one. Did you race in September at all?
I did a backyard ultra.
Amazing.
But I kind of did a Putney Loop backyard ultra, which is a great backyard ultra in London. Kind of like low key, but highly recommend. There's another one in 2026. But yeah, I kind of decided I was going to, because it was only 2 weeks before the Autumn 100, I thought, right, just do it. You know, I think I did 8 loops maybe.
Right.
So yeah, pulled out at 50k. So that was the only thing I did, yeah. And I paced a friend in the Royal Parks half marathon as well.
Nice.
But okay. not competitive running.
So you built back up to Autumn 100. What were your goals going into this race? Why did you choose this event?
I chose Autumn 100. Actually, I entered it a couple of days after Race to the Stones. Because Race to the Stones went quite well. If a race goes well, I tend to sort of, you know, you have a bit of a like, well, that's over now. I want something else to look forward to. So Race to the Stones runs along the Ridgeway, which two of the four legs of Autumn 100 cover. So I knew the course and I knew, you know, that it suits me quite well. The timing of the race as well, because it was October, I didn't have anything scheduled. So I thought, you know, I can fit this one in. But basically I chose it because it looked like it was going to be a potential fast 100 mile race, probably the fastest one that I was aware of, because I knew the Ridgeway legs, obviously in quite hot weather, ran them quite well. And then the other two legs I knew were like pretty flat along the Thames path. So I thought, well, I should do quite well in this race. So I thought this would be a good one to like try and go for a fast time.
Yeah, and the previous course record was just under 14 hours, I believe.
Mm.
And it's fair to say you absolutely blew the doors off it. Were you targeting sub 13 going into this? Was that on your mind that it might be possible?
Yeah. When I entered into the race, I thought, I was kind of thinking, looking at the course profile and how I ran the Race to the Stones, and I thought, if it's good conditions, I think I can go under 13 hours here. Then I recce'd the course like a few weeks ago, and after recce'ing it, I thought that might be tough because although like leg one, for example, was very like perfectly flat, but there's loads of gates. When you're trying to run like 4:30 per K, that does like, I think there must be like 40 gates on that leg or something, like there and back, because it's out and back.
Yeah.
So that slows you down quite a lot. And then I was kind of naively being London based, thinking Thames Path, I was just thinking, oh, this is going to be like hard packed just along the river, like kind of how it is in like Putney.
But, South Bank.
Yeah, but it's not so like that because we're so lucky with the conditions, it was very good running for sure. If it was wet and like in the weeks leading up, it wouldn't be a fast course, I don't think, because it could be very muddy. And lots of the course does run through on the Thames Path parts, legs. It does run through quite a lot of fields and like the ground's quite uneven. And it's just enough to like make it, it's, you know, maybe 10 seconds per k slower than what it would be if you're running on pavement. So I thought, after wrecking it, I thought 13 hours might be, I thought maybe it's just attainable, but it might be a bit of a push. But because conditions were really good, I thought, you know, try and give that a go.
And you ran with Callum Pritchard for quite a long time at the beginning of this race. How was that experience sharing the miles? Were you chatting or were you silent and locked in?
Yeah, it was great. Like very much chatting. For the first leg, basically chatting the whole way.
Yeah.
The second leg, it kind of, you're still talking, but like it go, you know, less frequent conversation, but still like a decent amount of time. We might have like 5 minutes where we're not saying anything, but then we'll talk. But yeah, it's great. Great chatting with Callum. Like, so for the first 50 miles, basically we ran together. Like we got towards the end of the second leg, which was, you know, maybe like 49 miles in, we got separated because he stopped to go to the toilet. Mm. But yeah, up until that point, we were running together the whole time. And yeah, it's good. It's like, just, it's much easier to stay like mentally fresh, I feel like, if you're running with someone. And even like with the gates and stuff, you can kind of like work together to get through them a bit easier than it would be if you're running on your own. But
yeah,
I was very much on the mindset of like, it'd be great to run with Callum and whoever else was up there for as long as possible, really. And I think it could have been for most of the race if it wasn't for the unfortunate injury.
Yeah. Yeah. Well done on placing that pothole where you did.
Yeah. We were actually discussing before it happened, just like how this ground is not, you have to concentrate basically. It's not like it's technical running terrain, but it's kind of quite easy to kind of lose concentration, but a lot of the ground's like uneven enough that, and some people I think were wearing road super shoes. And we were saying how we thought that, you know, that's potentially risky. But yeah, I had nearly had a couple of like rolls myself. So it was just, yeah, he thought he was okay. And, he thought it was like one you can kind of run off. And then I guess in time it just, it ballooned. But yeah, I'm glad. I don't think it's anything serious, luckily. So
yeah. Yeah. Hope Callum gets back to form soon. Well, as I understand it, you passed through the halfway point on track for the sub 13. What were the last few legs like? Obviously, at this point, you're running on your own. That last leg, because it's completely flat, obviously, along the Thames Path. But I imagine there's a sense in which that might make it a bit trickier because you're not forced to run, but at least you could, in theory, run the whole thing quite hard.
Yeah. So going in halfway, I felt I was basically on track. I had the 13-hour finish time like kind of in my watch. So I had this sort of a Pace Pro plan, which was a positive split. Because I think the pacing-wise, you're never going to run like an even split for over 100 miles. I think it's maybe possible over 100K, but not. I think 100 miles is really, you probably are going to always lose time if you're going to run it optimally. So I had, coming in at halfway point, I was kind of like maybe a couple of minutes behind, but then I ran leg three really well. And I felt like almost like I got a second wind on that leg. And I think I came in at the end of leg three, so starting leg four, 5 minutes ahead of 13 hour pace. And that's with like the slowdown already baked in on that fourth leg. Yeah. So at that point, I was like, I was even thinking about, like, I knew in Charmin run 12:44. I was thinking, that's maybe even on the cards. Like, as you say, like that last leg's relatively flat. There are a couple of hills in that last one. Leg one is completely flat, but the fourth one, you kind of like go into like a council estate and you go up a hill and, but yeah, it's mostly flat. And yeah, I was kind of like thinking, okay, definitely sub 13s on here. And I picked up my pacer then. It's like a little bit of a boost, but yeah, it's just, I think as you say, like you're just to maintain being on course fit, you have to be running basically the whole time. And I found like when I was running on like road or pavement, I would maybe be gaining and like going back under 13 hours. But then when you get onto like you're running for a field or you're going on like maybe a bit of a traily section, I find myself falling behind. So it's just like those small kind of margins of the terrain you're running on seemed to be the difference. And just running at night at that point, like when I left for leg four, it was basically pitch black. So it's obviously dark for the whole of that leg. And just I find you're running a bit slower than what you perceive you're running at that when it gets dark. Like something changes where it's just a bit harder to maintain the pace that you were doing before. But yeah, it was kind of I was terrible company for my pacer that leg. He was like, do you want to know the football scores? And I was just like, okay, yeah. But I hardly said anything to him apart from like, speed up a bit, please, or slow down, please. But yeah, it was like that leg did feel like a slog. And when it's like purely just a time goal, especially like an arbitrary time goal, like a 13 hours, just plucked, just because it's like a rounded number. When it gets really hard, you're like, I don't care enough to push myself. Like, yeah. I think if my life depended on it, I could have probably run under 13 hours. But I think around the turnaround point in Reading, I kind of realised that I was probably going to be a few minutes outside unless I really, like, really go for it.
Yeah.
So we kind of, like, had a chat and my patient was like, I think we should just, like, you know, take it easy. Not easy, but like not push too hard. Like in that fourth leg, it's weird when you look back on like what's slowing me down. Like what is it, like my muscles? Is it my energy levels? And I think it definitely was and has been historically just like I just start feeling sick and like my stomach feels bloated. Feels like it doesn't want to take on anything else. It's not like. I wouldn't say it's like I'm in like deep in like a pain cave or anything like that. I just feel like nauseous, and it's just like feel like if you push it more, you're gonna be sick, or maybe push yourself over some sort of thing where you slow down more. So it feels just like controlling your sort of kind of level, which is it's not easy to do. I mean, I think if it was a close finish, I maybe could have gone a bit faster. I think that kind of thing, you can find like another gear. Mm. But yeah, I was happy, very happy with the time, even if I
yeah, didn't. It's a phenomenal time. It's the fastest British trail 100 miler, and by more than almost 40 minutes, which is ridiculous. One thing I love about this performance, and I guess this race, although I've never taken part, is the video of you finishing, where it's in the centre of Goring Town. So people are clapping very quietly because they don't want to wake the neighbours up, and you just sort of slide past. I've finished Chilton Wonderland, which finishes in the same place. You sort of go down the side of a village hall. It's a very, very low key finish, and I think you just pass James Ellis. You just sort of go like, "Cheers."
Yeah,
it's so British. And I wondered actually about, because I feel like you're at quite an interesting point now. I know you've got more races booked for this year, but as we head into winter and sort of think about the big goals for next year, you have. I guess you have options in terms of what you want to pursue. And I'm curious about your take on, I guess I don't want to call it fame or celebrity, but like the pomp and the sort of hype around racing. Is that, I know you've got a place at UTMB next year. Do those races appeal to you, or do you still just want to be experimenting and trying big races, small races, you know, all kinds of things?
Yeah, I think like races like UTMB do appeal to me, not for the pomp, but for just the, you want to kind of measure yourself against the best people. Yeah. And Yeah, I think racing in the UK, you get really great runners and stuff. But obviously, racing in the big international races, you're racing against like the top people in the world.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not under some sort of, I don't think I'm at the stage now that I can be competitive in those kind of races. But I do have a goal of, you know, getting towards there. So I do want to race in big, you know, international races to see kind of where I stack up. But at the same time, I really enjoy, you know, racing in the UK and, you know, doing smaller, lower key races as well. So I think, I don't know exactly what I'm going to do next year, but I want to maintain the sort of racing quite often mentality. I've got a place for UTMB, so I probably will do UTMB or maybe CCC. But I wouldn't spend 3 months only focusing on that. And actually, I'm quite interested in going back to like road, but road ultras and exploring that side. For example, like ACP 100K, maybe like just to see Joe Turner again, if nothing else, on his own turf. Yeah. Rock up with my trail kit and just see how it goes. I'm quite interested to like my mentality this year is be like try different distances and different types of races. I think I've done that kind of only maybe just like one of each distance and stuff. But I think I've got a good insight into like, you know, what it takes in various distances and how I do in those distances. But I haven't tried road ultra. I'd be quite interested to try like a road 100K. And I think the training for like a road 100K and like runnable trails is not going to be that different. So I think for my focus for next year, I think it's going to be about like I'm quite keen to like try and get faster over like marathon type distance. See how that translates to like road ultras and the trails. Like the main, I think for next year, I think the South Downs Way 100, I definitely want to do that again. And that'll be like a goal race. And on the World Trail Majors, they've got, obviously you do generally do two races for it to count. And I kind of like that concept of doing like your local sort of race in the circuit. I'm lucky enough that I live quite close to the South Downs Way. And then doing one international one. So I'd be quite keen to maybe trying another race somewhere. Maybe Vietnam, the Vietnam Mountain Marathon. I've been to Sapa before, and like combining that with a holiday seems like it'd be good fun. But that would be a month after UTMB. So,
right.
Yeah. I haven't really decided. I'm keeping my mind quite open. I am keen on trying road ultras. So listening to Brian talk about Spartathlon as well, and that appeals. I'm not always thinking this comes from like road to trail, and then kind of like I don't want to go back and race the road. I think I like the road kind of and the sort of it's same with marathons. Like that kind of appeals to me, the way that you can like monitor your break, like you can really assess like your improvements like very accurately, and it's kind of like a different thing. Like I love the trail, and it's probably where I'll do most of my racing, but I still want to keep kind of like those kind of like other races which are maybe road or track, like what happened in the track 24 hours women's team and Sarah Webster and stuff. Since I don't think I'll be doing that in the next couple of years, but I think it's kind of inspiring that like seems like 40s is like the decade where you peak in those kind of distances, which is kind of cool. As someone who's like late 30s, it's kind of cool to think that, you know, maybe for like marathon distance, you're at the peak or past your peak. But for those longer distances, like you really can like be competitive, even at a global level into your 40s and 50s. And yeah, you see that on trail as well, but maybe not quite as much, but.
Yeah, it feels like at Centurion events, maybe the winner is usually late 30s, early 40s, but often on that top three, top five, there's guys in there into their late 40s, into their 50s.
Yeah, well, my first, the South Downs Way, when I was second last year, or sandwiched between 250-year-olds.
Yeah.
Which is, that's like, yeah, first of all, I can't believe that I finished second. And then probably even more than that, I can't believe that the winners in third place are in their 50s. It's like,
yeah,
very inspiring.
Yeah, I had three races that I was thinking of pitching to you. I don't know in what sense. I'm not your agent. But one was Spartathlon, which you mentioned. The other was Javelina, which we talked about. And the other was Western States, which is obviously a hard race to get into. But I know you say you don't feel like you're necessarily in a position to be competitive at these events yet. But I guess it depends on your definition, right? And often in ultras that are at that scale, top 10 is competitive. And I genuinely feel like you would have a shot at top 10 at Western States. It's just about finding your way there, I guess.
Yeah, I think in terms of like the, for Western States to get into those golden ticket races, I would say like Javelina and Autumn 100 probably aren't that dissimilar in terms of like course difficulty. I think Javelina's got slightly more, maybe slightly more elevation, it's hotter. But how many gates have they got there? They got
exactly. And I think it is actually a bit easier underfoot. From what I've seen, it's like what we would call paths, not trails.
Yeah, so I think like if we're looking at like last year's results, I think like, yeah, maybe I would have a shot at that kind of race as getting a golden. I think that would probably be my strongest bet out of the, because the Canyons 100K is super quick. I think I do want to work on that kind of that element of my running, and I think I've got untapped potential there. But that's a super competitive one. But I do think I don't think I'm at the level to like challenge for like golden ticket positions, but I'm hoping that maybe by the end of next year I could be. And so Western States 2027 is definitely on my radar. It's also really close to South Downs Way, so I'm entering the ballot this year, so we'll see. But I think I'll be trying to target that for 2027. So yeah, Javelina is definitely on my radar. Also, Tunnel Hill. It's like a really fast, they call it, like, I think it's classed as trail, but it's basically just like paved.
It's like a sort of bike path thing.
Yeah, it's like super, it's like road super shoe kind of course. But like running a fast 100, like a sub, maybe go for sub 12 hour. I think that the Tunnel Hill course, that'll be a quick course. I think that's going to be, it's not going to be that much slower than trying to do that kind of thing on track. And it's going to be psychologically less demanding, I think, if you try to do that than versus trying to do it on the track.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Has anyone told you that, so I don't know, Centurion have a list on their website of the fastest UK 100s ever. Your Autumn 100 time is 16th.
Okay.
That's obviously any surface.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious about whether that's something you would ever target. The fastest ever is Don Ritchie, apparently, in 1977.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. I am aware of that list. I think I do think sub 12 hours a realistic.
Yeah.
Realistic goal. Maybe not right now, but I think that is a realistic target for me. I think. Yeah, that's on my radar. I do want to do like, be it on the track or on the road, I do want to try like a fast 100 mile time. I think what intrigues me about that list is just how many of the best times have just from so long ago.
Yeah, I guess it's
like,
say.
I guess it's mostly because like the top runners just, it's just not something that they're targeting. I'm sure if they did, I mean, you've got like runners like Sorokin who's just run incredible times, but that's definitely something I'm interested in. And yeah, to run 100 miles, like if it's over in like under 12 hours, it's like running 100K in the mountains, isn't it? It's like, it's 100 miles, but it's not, you're not probably putting the impact of your body as you would be if you're doing like, in terms of time on feet, it's similar to what you would do in like a 100K in the mountains. So, for me, so far, I found that those races like over 14 hours, 15 hours, my stomach's never been able to cope with that. But up until that point, I think I can kind of like, I've got that kind of down. So a fast 100 or, maybe like if you're doing a mountain in the mountains, 100K, I'd be more confident of like putting in a good performance than those longer ones where there's so much that can go wrong and so much goes into it.
Yeah, I guess that would make that makes Spartathlon a bit of an unknown entity in that regard.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'd have to. I think I'd probably have to try like having solid foods if maybe if I'm going for those like over like 20 plus hours.
Yeah,
I'm doing the arc in January, so it'll be another test for that. That's another one where it's going to be a longer race.
Exciting. It's really exciting to have someone from these shores who is, you know, stepping up and considering these more international events. Just out of curiosity, what is your next race? You mentioned it's in November, so what are you doing in November and December?
Turin Marathon.
Turin, nice. Yeah. Amazing. Well, Hugh, really grateful for your time, and yeah, really good to catch up again, and really looking forward to seeing what you get up to next year. And my closing question is just about Autumn 100. Obviously, I think definitely in contention for performance of the year in the UK. What do you think is the most important thing you did right in this race?
I'm going to say not so much what I did right, but I got lucky, I think. I think I chose the sort of the right race. Everything just came together well on the day. I got the conditions leading up to the race meant the ground was really good. The weather on the day was really good. I was lucky that Callum was running in the first 50 miles. I was able to run with someone. I think just there's so many things that can go wrong in 100 miles. So to have a good day whilst the conditions are good on the right course, I think ultimately I was just quite lucky. and actually, just even to turn up at the event, I hit my toe a week before, just walking around the house on a bit like a bit of skirting, and it got all purple.
Oh man!
Sent a photo to ChatGPT. It said, "Yeah, it's broken." Like ChatGPT was horrified that I was considering running like a week later, and I thought I'd be out of the race, and then luckily it was just badly bruised, and a few days later I was all right. Such small things can make a big difference. I think I was quite lucky ultimately.
Yeah, that's interesting that you use ChatGPT. One thing I was going to ask, sorry, I said it was closing question, but it just struck me. You seem like a guy who doesn't, doesn't worry too much about kit, right? Like,
what are you trying to say?
like you raced, I remember at Race to the Stones, you were wearing like an old half marathon or marathon t-shirt or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it's a good t-shirt, obviously, and you trust it. But you don't seem like someone who's investing hundreds of pounds in flash kit. So just thinking about progression in the sport and the possibility of sponsors knocking on the door and stuff, like just where do you stand on that side of things, like needing the best kit? Because you clearly demonstrate that you don't need to invest in the absolute flashiest, latest kit to have these performances.
Yeah, I think the fashion aspect I just take from just regular life where I'm not particularly invested in brands and stuff, and I tend to not, you know, spend that much on clothes and stuff. In terms of sponsors, it's a weird one. I think with a sponsor, you want to kind of like the brand and believe in the brand. But I think at least in the UK, it's quite, you have to really be really quite a top level to attract paid sponsorship. And for me, like, I've already got the kit, so like offering free kit to endorse a brand, it doesn't really do that much for me.
Or you have to be relatively prolific on social media, which
doesn't
seem like something you're that.
I'm not, in. Yeah. I've only got Instagram this year, so I'm all quite new to that. Even just like I never had a personal Instagram profile, so even just like the basics for that I'm all quite new to. But yeah, I think social media is a big part of it, and if you're not good at or particularly bothered about doing social media, you have to be really, really good at running. better than me. it's definitely something I'm open to, but I see it. It's like I'm very new into the sport, and I feel like there's probably I have quite a lot of untapped potential. So I'm not in a rush to try and attract sponsors or anything like that.
Exciting. Well, I really look forward to seeing what the next few years bring. Thank you so much, Hugh, for joining me.
Cheers, Ed. Thanks for having me.